Hello and welcome back to another episode of Cycling Mo, your cycling informant. Today I am delighted to be joined by the living legend that is Matthew Heyman. Matt, how are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for coming on the podcast. Now, today it is the day I won Paris-Roubaix. So we have the man himself, 2016 Paris-Roubaix winner, possibly one of the most iconic wins in living memory, considering you were in the morning break. And we're going to have a look back at that day, the special moments, and hopefully we can live it through your shoes. So we'll rewind to the winter of 2015. And is it right that you started winter training about October?
Maybe you have more information than I do, being a cycling informant. Yeah, I probably would have. I'm trying to work out which world championships it would have been, but I normally race through to the world championships, have a small break, but I'm already, you know, starting to think about the classics, and also, you know, Tour Down Under is a pretty big race for us. So, yeah, normally probably don't have as long a break or as good a break as I probably should over the winter, and keen to get back to it. So, yeah, probably October, November, back into some big Ks.
And as you say, you did kind of Tour Down Under, Cadell's race, big focus obviously on the classics. It's what kind of you're all about. And then you go and have that well-publicised crash in Umlaut Het Nieuwsblad on the 27th of February, where I think you fractured your arm, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, even before that, we went straight from Australia to altitude training camp in South Africa with pretty much the whole team. We did that 2 years, and I'm not sure if that was the first or the second year, but it was a tough training camp in, you know, pretty hot conditions in South Africa. And I remember at that training camp, I was probably going too well. I was out with the climbing group sometimes and really putting in some big days and really suffering a lot with the eye on the classics. And, yeah, came in, the Nieuwsblad, was feeling pretty good in the race, tried to jump across to what would have been the winning move, didn't make it, came back to the group and thought, well, oh, that's you know, we've got tomorrow, we've got Paris-Nice coming up, we've got all these other races. I'm kind of where I need to be. I missed the move and came around the corner onto, the Hahook. And, yeah, somebody in front of me, their bars snapped off and that was it, down, and fractured my radius head. I knew straight away something was pretty wrong.
Yeah, I suppose that kind of spell afterwards, your focus is Paris-Roubaix, I would imagine. It's the 27th of February. How long did the doctors say you would be out for?
6 weeks.
So that takes you beyond?
It takes me one day before Roubaix, they said, so... Yeah, so I looked at it straight away and, you know, it was a Saturday. It was still Saturday evening when I'm in the ER, and I looked 6 weeks, and that was the day before Roubaix. But, you know, the team doctor just looked and said, look, all your classics are done, you know. Go back, recover from this, talk to the team, you know. Maybe there's a different program for you, but your classics are done.
No, not to be cheeky or rude, you know, at that point, you weren't a spring chicken.
No.
Possibly could have been one of your last kind of Roubaix as a kind of team leader. Just what kind of thoughts were going through your mind when you're thinking, I think I might miss this one?
It was probably all that work that I did. Like I said, the training in Australia going pretty well at Down Under. Felt like I had good form and had a couple of, you know, years where I'd come to Orica Green Edge or Green Edge and hadn't really shown them, you know, what I was capable. I hadn't shown them the results that I was getting at Sky, and kind of felt that I'd done all the work to be in that position. So it was more about just all that work, I guess, more than, you know, missing out, just like how much I'd given up in the 3 months before that. Just to let it all go. Yeah, so week after week, just watching the classics slip away and wasn't really getting... I mean, it was in the cast for 10 days. I felt after a few days, the doctors have got it all wrong. It's not even sore. And then when I did get the cast cut off, that was a bit of a shock to me that, you know, my arm dropped and it was still pretty sore, and I thought, oof, that's not... You know, I kind of felt like even after 10 days it had healed, and maybe they got the diagnosis a little bit wrong because it wasn't very sore.
when did you start thinking, I can make this race?
Oh, never really. I don't even know why I was on the home trainer. I mean, kind of. There was all different emotions, I guess. There was times I rang the team and asked them about doing the Giro. I was told that those spots were already filled. So that's why, you know, back to the trainer. So what? Why am I doing this? Other times, you know, at one stage I thought maybe if I, to do Roubaix, you had to do Flanders, and to do Flanders, you had to do the Punner. So I was like counting back, and I rang the team and said, okay, so if I can ride, can I start in the Punner? And they said, well, your bikes aren't even in Belgium. They're still in Italy in the service course. So that was a bit, well, they'd pretty much written me off. So I was kind of in no man's land. And Matt Wilson, who's one of the directors at Roubaix, and, you know, he says to this day that even on the Wednesday before Roubaix, he wasn't sure that I was going to be starting on Sunday.
So those legendary garage sessions that you were doing, double sessions, so why were you doing it? Do you know?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, and now even more so, now that I'm retired and realise that you don't have to train like an idiot constantly. I guess it was, yeah, you kind of lose your identity as an athlete if you're not training. You know, that's what you're just programmed to do. And any time that you're not doing that, you just feel like you're going backwards. There was that glimmer that I could make it back, you know, otherwise I wouldn't have been asking the question, where are my bikes? And you know, I felt like the arm was getting better, even though slowly, and I never really, you know, it's not an art, it wasn't Milan San Remo I was aiming for, you know, it's Paris-Roubaix, you know, so it's, you're never sure, even until the Wednesday myself. You know, the weekend before, instead of doing Flanders, I went and raced in Spain for that very reason, to try and, you know, give myself a chance to come back into the peloton without putting the pressure of the cobbles. And that went well, but still, you know, okay, I went through some potholes, I went over some speed bumps. You're still not sure what's going to happen after a couple of sections of cobbles.
And then I suppose you went and did recon. Did you do recon?
Yep, I did the recon on the Wednesday or the Thursday. I think it was a Wednesday, actually. So, yeah, I came in super fresh, came off the weekend racing in Spain, which was Rojas and GP Miguel Indurain. There I, you know, surprised myself with my form. Injury, and I jumped in the breakaway early. There's a pretty big, decent climb in the middle of the race, and our breakaway kind of got caught there, and I chased, you know, I was far enough up that climb to still be in the race, chased as long as I could, gave myself a really good workout, backed up the next day and swapped off all day, knowing that I was trying to give myself some of that kind of real race feeling and simulation. Wednesday, again, the coach was like, you know, he's starting to get confident, said my numbers were good on the weekend and wanted me to really go deep on the recon. So while the guys were pretty tired still from all the classics and Flanders, I was giving it some stick on the Wednesday.
Now, when you sat down to discuss team tactics, had your team meeting, what was your role?
We had two leaders, Jens Cochlaire and Luke Durbridge, and I was there for my experience, and I had a free role, and I asked to have a free role to, you know, see how I was going and then make the call. And yes, Roubaix is a special race for me, and I've always, you know, and I've kind of moved teams to have a good shot at that, after riding for Sky and having, you know, too many guys there in the final, and I really wanted to have a chance myself. I'm still realistic enough in every other race throughout the season that I know that, you know, if there's another rider that's better than you and they're on your team, you just do the job. So I wanted to give myself a fair shot, but definitely the other two guys, Jens and Luke, had been riding a good classics campaign, and they're both, you know, highly motivated for Roubaix just as I was. So that was the role going in.
So then, race itself, you have, it was a bit of a crazy opening 60K, brake didn't form, and then all of a sudden on that tiny kind of little uphill, the brake goes. I think, was it Magnus Cort, first of all, then you've went across. What, that was that just an instinctive thing to go in the move at that point, or
I'd said to Matt Wilson the night before too, I said, oh, look, if it's been going on for a long time and we designated two or three guys to be jumping with moves, I said, maybe I'll start to look around if we get close enough to the cobbles. You know, it's a nice, you know, just start with a couple of minutes, get through. Because you do spend a lot of energy on those first sectors trying to, you know, it's a big build-up to get into those first few sectors. Matt wasn't, you know, he wasn't keen on the idea. He, you know, kind of thought, well, it's a fair bit of energy starting to jump into moves when you're only 10K or 15K from the cobbles. How far are you really going to get? And he has a fair point. You know, it was once before I spent all my cookies jumping a move after two or three sectors, and we never got more than 2 minutes because the bunch is just continually racing for each sector. There's no real let up where you can get 3-4 minutes. So, you know, so he wasn't 100% on board with that, but, you know, I just was feeling pretty confident that day in my ability and just kind of seized the moment. It was in my head, otherwise I wouldn't have brought it up with Matt the night before. And you know, I was looking at the way the race was going and there had been a couple of big moves and they'd almost stuck. And I felt like, you know, it was the moment. And it showed that, you know, a fair portion of those guys were in the same boat as Magnus and had been jumping for 70, 80 kilometres in almost every move. And so by the time we got out there, you could tell that a lot of those guys, their job was just to get in the break and they were, that was their race.
So it was a break of 16 men, large break. Then I think Quick Steps decided that it was a bad idea, so they start chasing and I think the gap was like about a minute. And then you hit the cobbles and it's still kind of close and Sky start riding on the front, even though they had, I think, Puccio in the break with you. And it looked like the break wasn't going to get a big gap, like you just said, you know, sometimes only 2 minutes. In those stages, when the gap was like a minute, what were you thinking? Were you thinking, this isn't it?
Yeah, no, just conserve. Just, I was really kind of, I'd been in other situations where I'd made breakaways and really, you know, got excited too early and tried to push the breakaway. So I was thinking, well, I'm here and I don't decide when we get caught. It's not up to me. I'm not going to single-handedly drag this break around. If it's 10K from now, that's 10K. I get a free ride. If it's 20K, you know, I just want to get as far as possible. And you set little goals. You think, oh, well, I'm going to get through the forest. Or if I get to this sector, it'll be good. If I get through that sector, that's good. So every time I ticked off a sector that I wasn't having to fight in the peloton was, you know, was good for me. So, yeah, really trying to just, you know, not get too excited with the situation and just and go into it with the expecting to get caught. So not trying to push that break like it was going to stay away. It wasn't to see how far I could be out there. It was definitely, okay, I'm in this break and it's just an advantage until I get caught and then I need to be ready to race.
Then all of a sudden the pace goes off the chase. The gap does go out. I think you get up to about kind of 4 minutes or so and then they start to go again and we get a big, big crash on the cobbles after we're about 115 kilometres to go. And the peloton is down to like 20 guys. I think a teammate was in that kind of front group as well. What information are you getting? Does that change how you're feeling in the break?
No, I still haven't seen the whole race. I have it on DVD somewhere, but for ages there, I'd planned actually 1 year to go and watch it at Christmas with the family because I haven't seen it. And for the weeks afterwards, it was too emotional to even to think about sitting down. And now it's too far gone to sit down and watch it to go and sit through 6 hours of it. But at some point I will. So, yeah, I've seen the highlights and I know that there was, you know, an incident, a crash, and I could hear things on the radio and you kind of hearing things on the side of the road and you're never sure is it, you know, who's crashed, who's the ones chasing. You're hearing Boone and you're hearing Sagan and, yeah, it was a bit hard to know what was going on. So the first time I really knew something was at the end of Sector 13, which is the one after the second feed, Mark Maddio, and those lead guys come across to us and Luke Durbridge is in there. So he's followed the best guys in the race at that point. So, yeah, he He rocks up, catches us, looks across to me, says, "Hey, Matty, how are you going?" I said, "Good." I attack straight away in the streets there because I know the next section's Orchies, and I know that, you know, it's often one with a bit of crosswind, and wanted to kind of try and create a new group there if that front group was going to settle down and wanted to try and get away. First two attacks didn't really work. But I'm thinking about, you know, Luke's here and he's riding really well. We go on to the next section, Orchies, and he gets a puncher. So I'm back by myself again.
For those that don't know, so in the crashes and in the chaos, Cancellara and Sagan, possibly the two big favourites, they're caught behind the main peloton, which has got Bonin and Quickstep, and they're really going. So it was like almost like mini chases, which I suppose Roubaix is often like. Then, as you mentioned, you get caught with about, I think it was 63k to go. It all combines together. But again, the front group's quite small.
Yeah, it's not a very big group that catches us there at all. You know, we're down to probably, I'm testing my memory here, probably 8 or 10 guys from the original group, and there's probably only 10 or 15 guys that catch us there.
Then the next kind of big action, Monzon Pivel, it goes down to 7 men. The attacks go, and yourself and Erviti, who also was in the morning break, used to are the only two standing at that point. As the group starts to get smaller and smaller, what are you thinking?
Yeah, so when I look back at the race, you know, that kind of shows me then at 50k to go and the end of Mont Pavel's 50k to go, and I've always said that's kind of, for me, that's kind of the start of the final of Roubaix. If you can get to that point in the race, you're kind of in the race. There's a bit of a lull after Mont Pavel, but there's some big sectors before that, between the second feed and Mont Pavel, there's a lot normally happens. I do distinctly remember we turned there's a couple of corners on Mont Pavel, and we turned the right hand where you got a little bit of asphalt, and they started to go. I don't know if it was Stannard or Tom went off the front, and I definitely was ready just to follow the wheel I was on. I think I was on Seberg's wheel, and at that point I said, no, I've got to try and see if I can follow these guys, you know, because I was, you know, feeling I've been in the break all day. I don't have a lot of confidence from racing week in, week out. And, you know, do I defend just kind of being in this group and try, if I put myself out there on this sector, you know, I could, you know, blow up and get dropped. But yeah, when you come off that sector and they're pretty much, it was pretty much the names that went into the velodrome, Bara Viti, you know, it was Tom and Stannard, Boonen, Boasenhagen, myself. And that's 50k to go. A lot of guys came back, but the guys that turned off Mont Pavel at 50k to go were the same guys that went into the velodrome.
Yeah, then, as you mentioned, slight regrouping, sector 5, Camphon on Pavel, then it's down to 5. And nobody else is getting back. You mentioned them all, apart from Van Mark. So Bonin, Stannard, Van Mark, Boasenhagen, yourself. And the race is on. Nobody has teammates. It's proper racing. You go into Cafo de Labra, and Stannard gives you a little nudge, let's just say, which I'm sure you were cussing him at the time.
Yeah, look, experience is a great thing to have, but I've also seen a number of guys crash on that very corner in Roubaix. So having ridden it a number of times, I think Johan van Zummer and Fletcher had a bingle on that corner, and I was very aware maybe I overreacted to the nudge I got from Stannard. I thought that I was ready to lead on to Carrefour de l'Arbre. You know, I'd done a couple of hundred metres turn since the sector before, and then next minute, just before the corner, people start passing me on all sides, and next minute I'm last. Ian was the last one to try and get underneath inside the corner. You know, Mum wasn't very happy with him. She was throwing things at the television. That's kind of done. You know, you're entering this sector. I was you know, kind of thinking I was the weakest guy off the breakaway. I'd been out there all day. I hadn't raced for a month. You know, you've got a few doubts, and then you're 20 metres off the back. And I guess after the second corner there, I just figured, well, you know, I'd been in that situation a number of times. I've had a crash around that area. I've had punches towards the end of Roubaix, and I figured, you know, I can't really just, you know, I guess one of the first thoughts was, how far are those guys behind me? You know, I'm you know, going to run top five here, which would have been my best result. Now I'm off the back. You know, I could get 20th. You know, it's easily that a group just steamrolls past you, or just think, okay, I've just got to give it my best shot. And, you know, maybe that changed the final for me, because getting back on, all of a sudden I thought, wow, I've ridden back across to these guys who are chasing for Mark as hard as they can. And I felt like I had a bit of a secret from that moment on, that I was actually a lot better than, you know, than I thought I was going into Carrefour de l'Arbre. And Carrefour's, you know, a really, really hard sector, and there's no real way to, it's up there, it's at the end of a long hard race, and you know, if you can show any kind of form there, and if you're able to, you know, hold some kind of form on that sector, you know, I've had my lights go out there so many times, all of a sudden I started to gain confidence.
And then the last couple of sectors tick over, it's still the five guys together. At what point do you start thinking about the run for home, your tactics? What are you going to do? Can you think about that in that moment?
It's a strange one. I mean, I've watched other guys in those situations at the end of, you know, nail-biting situations. There you are. You've got 2-3K to go in Roubaix, and you're in with a chance. But strangely enough, I wasn't really feeling the pressure. I thought that I'd be happy if I ever got on the podium in Roubaix, and I guess at some point I was thinking, look, you know, I can wrap a few of these guys up, and there's a good chance I get to stand on the podium inside that velodrome, and you know, that was already something that I was aiming for. But that being said, you know, kind of instincts took over. You know, going over the top of Boonen in the last 2K, and then even to the point of not riding with him into the velodrome. If I really had just been content with getting a podium spot, all I had to do was pull a big turn there and I would have been second in Roubaix. So somewhere deep down, yeah, I was growing in confidence, but I wasn't feeling the pressure of that. I was just felt more and more confident as closer to velodrome as I got. It was a bit of a strange kind of feeling, you know, from being knocked off the wheel to just starting to feel like, yeah, and it's easy when you win to speak like that. And there's been times in other races that I thought I'm going to win this for sure, and I haven't. But I started to feel that confidence kind of growing, and feeling more in control. I wasn't making decisions. I was just doing what I felt was right.
The final 5K was just all out crazy. So I think it felt like everybody tried an attack. It was brought back, another attack, and it seemed like everyone was on the limit. Now, obviously, it's the end of Roubaix. Everybody's on the limit. But you've been in the break most of the day, and you're looking around and you're seeing guys, and, you know, you mentioned there, you're getting more confident. You're thinking, maybe I've got this guy.
But you're never really sure. I mean, you look at the guys, and I know them all pretty well. I've been on the team with two of them. I live in Belgium, so I know Tom and you know, they're national heroes, and Tom and Sepp. I mean, they're national heroes here. They're in the papers. They're on the television. I know them pretty well. I've been on the team with the other two guys. They all had a lot to lose, a lot more to lose than I did. I was just along for the ride and had everything to win. Tom is a very, very cool competitor. He would not have been feeling the pressure of that situation. I mean, he'd been in that situation so many times, but Sepp definitely felt the pressure, I think, and Edvald and Ian as well. Yeah, we were attacking each other going over the top, and it just felt like going back racing when you were a kid. Yes, it was a final of Roubaix, but we were just kind of trying things, and you're you're testing each other, but you also don't want to expose yourself totally. So although you don't want to just miss that jump, and it only takes, you know, for me to think that somebody else is going to jump, for the other guy to get 5 meters. So there is a bit of nervousness there, but we were just kind of touching each other up and seeing if anybody was going to crack, and yeah, it was definitely exciting.
So then you mentioned that Boonen goes, just over 2K to go. You close the gap, and as you're closing it, everybody who's watching is thinking the same thing. Is he going over the top? Is he going to? And yeah, over the top you go, and you get a good gap.
Yeah.
And for a moment there, it looked like that was it.
I didn't realise that I had a gap like that. I mean, I look around at a point, it's all pretty surreal. I've raced those roads a number of times. Often I've been riding down there by myself, 10 minutes behind the last group. But yeah, again, like I said, it was a good touch up, but I also wasn't, you know, when you see the footage and you can watch Tom, you don't normally see Tom rocking and rolling like that. He was obviously under a lot of pressure there, but at the time I didn't know that. And you know, it was an attack to see if, you know, the other guys caught him. Do they swing across the road? It was an attack like that. Are they going to call each other's bluff? And I didn't know that he was on the ropes as much as he was, that he was really struggling to get back. And again, you know, maybe it was that attack that just softened him up enough in the sprint, because normally you'd put money on Tom over me any day.
So then you mentioned you don't work with him. He kind of leads out the last couple of K, you go into the velodrome, he slows down a little bit, the guys from behind catch back up, but in all honesty, they look like they're finished.
Yeah.
And then he's deciding he's going to lead out the sprint. So what's in your mind? Because you've just mentioned that this is Tom Boonen, this is a guy who wins bunch sprints.
Yeah, I think a little bit... again, so if I did just want the podium, then I probably... should have just done a turn and I would have been pretty much assured of second place there. As we enter the velodrome, Sepp catches us. But I'm thinking, you know, again, at the last minute I see them all coming and I think, okay, if I lead out, there's no way I'm going to not run top three, and I give myself a chance pretty much. I mean, I come from a track background. I grew up racing the velodrome like many Australians. It's not a standard velodrome, and even though I'd been there however many times, 15 times before, I did get the meters a bit wrong. I thought it was a bit shorter than it was. So when I hit out down the back straight and I enter turn three, I look up and saw 200 there on the entry, and I thought, woof, I've gone a bit early here, because, you know, I grew up on a 333-meter track where the 200-meter line was in turn between turn one and two. So I did misjudge it, but if, you know, you're on a Roubaix bike with flat tyres, and I know from velodrome, that from racing on the track, that, you know, if you're in front and you're leading out, that the guys have to go up and they have to make extra metres. And when you're that tired and after a race like that, I just felt like that was the best place to be. You know, if in doubt, just lead out, and then they had to, if three guys got past me, then hats off to them. So that was kind of the theory there.
You get a good swing off the ramp coming down. As you mentioned, took most people by surprise because it was a bit further out than most people would have gone for it. And then everybody's waiting for Boonen to win. Let's be honest. You know, he's there trying to win his fifth. And he slightly gets boxed in from behind you. And then the last 100 metres, it opens up and he comes round, and then he doesn't have it.
Yeah, no, from the exit of the corner, I felt, I was watching the wheels between my legs, and they just weren't coming, and not quick enough. You know, I was hoping that finish line would come very quickly. Yeah, he got boxed in slightly there. If you know, maybe if he'd you know, held me on the hip there, it probably would have stopped everybody else, and maybe he'd had a chance. Instead, he kind of let me come past. Whether he knew everybody was back, I don't know. But, yeah, just watching the wheels up the front straight, and they weren't coming. And then I guess, like I said, a lot of that final was kind of a weird state of just kind of doing what I knew you should be doing, but I didn't feel like I was you know, 100% present in some way, that I was just racing how I knew you were supposed to race in the finals of these races. I'd raced the race enough. And then when I crossed the finish line, I think it's when I just thought, what just went on? I was a bit in disbelief.
That looked like shock.
Yes, it was.
Looking back, can you put into words those initial emotions, you know, that kind of first hour after you've won? Can you remember it? Is it just like a blur?
Yeah, it is. And I think more and more it's becoming what I see on the video or the clips, you know, the backstage pass, which I'm lucky enough to have. That's becoming more and more my memory of it, because, you know, my actual memory of it, I guess, disappears after years and years. And the more I see that, that's what I kind of remember. And it was pretty much a blur. It happened pretty quickly. And I was just like, I knew I was on a good one, but you don't normally beat Bonan, not when he's going for his fifth. That just doesn't happen. So, yeah, not off the home trainer, not off some Swift sessions.
And then straight after, did you go for a famous shower in the shower block?
I don't think I got there in the end, no. So I went into did the press conference in the new velodrome, which is next door. And from there straight to the bus. I was pretty keen to see the rest of the guys. So, yeah, I missed out on the showers, but I've been back since.
And where is your shower?
I think it's in the second lot down the back somewhere.
What's that like, Kevin? Because obviously everybody knows the history. You know, you walk in that god-awful shower room.
Well, actually, the whole velodrome outside of one day in April is in a bit of disrepair. And I mean, you know, there's quite a romantic kind of thought about Roubaix and all of those symbols that come with it. You know, the velodrome is a symbol, the stone's iconic, and the showers, having a plaque in a shower. But, you know, it means so much to people. And, yeah, like you said, those showers are pretty awful, 364 days a year, and then all of a sudden they're full of photographers and less and less bike riders, I must say. I do try and convince, you know, when I first turned pro, we would definitely go there with everybody. And with the invention of, you know, the touring bus and the showers, it's become less and less. And I think most of the young guys are definitely, you know, it's a good idea to have at least been in there once or twice. And then if you want to use the bus, use the bus.
I read that Maddio used to make his whole team go in for a shower back in the old days.
There's still a few. I know that the Trek guys and John Dingenkop very much, they're always in there. And you know, the race has a number of guys in the peloton that are fascinated with just that race. And you've had them over the years, whether it's, you know, Roger Hammond or Magnus Backstead. I race with guys, Fletcher, Leon van Bon. You've got these Mark Walters. They're just, you know, like myself, passionate about that race and all of it. You know, Mitch Docker. And you'll find him in the showers every year because they're just passionate about everything that the race stands for.
Then that evening, what happened that night after your win?
Well, speaking of Mitch Docker, he was trying to get the surgery reopened at the local hospital because he'd lost half his face in Arenberg. So our team doctor was there and he did a great job, you know, convincing the doctors that he needed to be operated on that night and, you know, probably got a lot better job done than waiting till the next day. So, you know, our thoughts were with Mitch. You know, it was a pretty serious accident and it took him a long time to come back from that, and that was probably the reason that moustache hung around for as long as it did. But we had actually, funny enough, we'd planned for the whole team to stay and go out to dinner, which was the first time that had been pre-planned, whether we... for whatever reason, the team had said, look, this Classics campaign, it's a group of guys who build up from October all the way through and you spend all that time up in Belgium going from race to race and then, yeah, Roubaix happens. 9 times out of 10, it's a disappointment. 9 times out of 10, the whole Classics are a disappointment. And everyone gets on a plane and goes home. And we thought, you know, look, let's have a nice dinner and... We went to a restaurant. We'd already booked it in the centre of Ghent, Belle Queen, and we had a private room upstairs. And so it was all prepared. We had a really nice dinner, and I tried to not look at my phone.
And where's the trophy? Where does it sit now?
It's in my living room. The living room has a recess on one wall that has a couple of spotlights on it, so it sits in the middle. And you know, I used to look at it. I've got a photo somewhere on my Instagram where my son's built a whole pile of Lego over the top of it. There's not a lot of respect shown for it from anybody else, but I still look at it every now and again. You know, and it takes, you know, something like this, you know, to bring back those memories, and it's something, you know, it's associated with me from now on. And you know, I couldn't think of a better race to be associated with. And a lot of people ask about the rock, and but it kind of, it's not that I don't look at it every single day and notice it as much as I did, but it's very much in the centre of the living room, and I don't think that'll change. I think it'll have pride of place wherever I am.
What cool things have happened since that point? What doors opened?
Yes, probably 2 weeks later, I was invited by the French Prime Minister to the palace on the Champs-Élysées. They were hosting the Australian dignitaries and the Governor General. So I jumped on a train down to Paris, met Shane Bannon, our general manager, and, you know, we were wined and dined with other dignitaries in the palace on the Champs-Élysées, and I thought I could get used to this, and that's probably the last time I've been invited to anything. So it was pretty short-lived. That was pretty cool experience. But, you know, just pretty much just having people, you know, it's, you go to a bike race and people tell you're a legend for winning Roubaix, pretty much. That's pretty cool. It doesn't really get old. People like to tell you how it either inspired them or what they were doing. A lot of Australians were waking up households and children and dogs and wives at 3 o'clock in the morning. And yeah, it's nice if you get stopped in an airport and someone can tell you even now exactly what they were doing when I won that race, that you've, you know, I'd never, you know, you do this sport because you love it, and I was, you know, self-focused that whole time. But to find out that, you know, people got that emotional about you winning something on the other side of the world at 3 o'clock in the morning is pretty cool.
Now, you were asked before the race started what advice you would give, and your phrase was, just keep riding. Does that still count? Is that still your advice?
Yeah, and that comes from Mark Walters, actually. He used to just say it to me all the time, and it was something he'd say in Dutch, is Alto Blijf Rijden. And we still see, even when I still see him at a race now, he's the director on Lotto Soudal, and he still says it to me. So, you know, and it's true for that race more than most, but I think in life in general. And I think, I guess, coming back from that injury, more so than actually in the race of Roubaix, as, you know, I was pretty lucky that day and everything went right and I didn't have to come back from much. But that was my mantra for the race, but probably more so coming back from that injury, that, you know, I didn't give up, and why was I doing double ergo sessions when I really probably should have just been doing something else. But, yeah, just keep riding.
Now, you're in your new role working with the team. Have you been back as a DS yet in the car?
Yeah, I have.
And what's that like compared to riding?
Pretty stressful. Yeah, so first of all, I mean, even the first experience in a car as a DS, I was in Spain. I Matt White said, I'll come down here. It's a nice, easy race. I'll teach you the ropes. No problem. And jumped out of the bus, and he was sitting in the passenger seat, and I thought, well, that's a bit of a problem. So first day of driving in the Peloton, and it was quite an eye-opener, even though I'd spent 20 years in the Peloton as a rider. it really is a different world behind the bunch, and I really had quite a lot to learn and had to start from zero of, you know, exactly how the convoy works and realise that most of the riders are idiots. So I jumped the fence pretty quick. No. It's just they do have a hell of a lot of trust in you as a driver, and the guys, and I didn't realise that I put that much trust in the directors as I did as a rider, that you just swarm past cars at 60k an hour and expect them to stop and always do the right thing. And so, yeah, I came in from my first couple of races as a director and was flat out in the back of the bus asleep when the riders had raced all day. But, yeah, Roubaix, look, I was just trying to keep my head down and try and stay focused on the race, because there is so much going on. There's riders everywhere and there's cars everywhere, and, you know, we've got one person driving and one person in the passenger seat, and I was in the passenger seat, so I'm just really trying to get information, trying to, you know, motivate the guys, give them the information they need to race and not get distracted by everything else that's going on and kind of lose sight of the race. So I'll tell you what, the race goes by pretty quick when you're in the team car. You're just concentrating the whole time.
And looking back at your win now, a couple of years have passed, what are your kind of your emotions? What do you think about when you just remember it? What sticks out?
Oh, I guess when I came down off the podium and my mother, my brother, my wife and my son were there, and they don't really come to many bike races. My brother's he's got a bike shop in Holland, and he's driven down to Roubaix, who's probably the only race he would come and watch, and he had for a number of years. And my mum had flown over. She liked to come and watch all the classics because she's a pretty big cycling fan, and to support me. And, yeah, my wife had decided to come along that year. So that was pretty special to have a family there, and they don't come to many races, and to get off the podium and just to see that they were had all been bawling. You know, everybody had red eyes, and my son pretty much didn't know what was going on. So,
well, thank you very much, Matt, for sharing with us the day you won Roubaix. I think everybody's loving that chat. It's such an iconic race, and I had so much fun going back and just watching it. I think you forget what a tremendous win it was that day. So thanks for taking your time out to talk to us tonight. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review it. Matt Heyman, thank you very much.